Hello and welcome to another edition of the Gobesky Wallace Report. My name's Adam Gobesky.
And I'm Charlie Wallace. Welcome to the 11th edition of our sci-fi shuffle. We've got three amnesiacs with us today. We've got...
Again, we don't have to do a theme. You can just say guests.
We've got three guests with us today. We've got Paul Wilcox.
It's great to be here.
We've got Dan Hess.
Very happy to be here.
And Doug Gobesky.
Thanks for having me.
And I'm not doing a bit. I'm literally forgetting every single time that I don't have to do that.
I know. This is why I don't want you to be my radiation technician. I'm worried about your attention to detail.
Oh, but I do that all at work, so I can't do it at home. I'm all detailed out.
Yeah. Budget.
Tapped out. And so we're here discussing a movie that Dan Hess picked last time, and that's the 1998 film Dark City. Why'd you pick this movie, Dan?
There was a restriction on decades, as
which
well
I will
as...
lift at some point, but
as well as I was
my 2010s movies again.
I was trying to find something that I hadn't seen, and that I thought maybe some others hadn't seen. And that looked kind of interesting and seemed to have decent Google Rotten Tomatoes type reviews, so it wouldn't be too terrible. And this kind of fit that Venn diagram of all those things, so I was like, let's give this one a whirl. And nobody objected, so here we are.
I had actually seen the movie before because I think I picked it up in the clearance section of like a Half Price Books, the Blu-ray copy, and I watched the theatrical cut. But... research on the internet suggested that the director's cut is the superior version, and so I watched that for the first time for this podcast.
I had seen this before, too, sometime in undergrad. I don't remember exactly when, but yeah, this is my first time seeing the director's cut as well.
Well, I was fortunate enough that Adam gave me a heads up right before I watched it to say, hey, if you haven't watched it yet, watch the director's cut.
Oh, I didn't realize Blu-ray. It was that early.
The Blu-ray I had picked up had both versions, so I chose wisely. Though I will say, after I watched the director's cut, I went back and watched like the opening of the theatrical version to see like how it was different, because what little I knew was that was a big part of the difference. And I have thoughts on that later, as far as like whether or not the difference was worth it.
Okay.
I actually saw this way, way back when, probably not even in this century, caught it on TV, which means I've now seen the TV edit and the director's cut, but not the theatrical cut.
So you saw the theatrical cut minus the boobs.
I assume.
And probably a couple of the violent scenes.
I seem to recall the guy getting his head chopped open. So
okay, so just boobs then.
Probably just the boobs.
America.
Classic.
Wow.
Paul, had you seen this? I don't know if you said something.
No, yeah. No, I haven't. And no, I didn't see this yet.
So it was my birthday recently. And,
happy birthday.
Thank you. And Doug bought me some Japanese candy that I'm going to try on the podcast. I know we don't normally do this during Sci-Fi Shuffle, but I want to eat it. So... this is Hokkaido matcha milk candy.
Ooh.
From Kasugai. It says it's a hard candy. The gift message says, ooh, piece of candy from Doug. So this is made in a facility that uses fish, almonds, wheat, and peanuts. So all right. Oh,
fish
individually
and almonds, that sounds delicious.
I know. Individually wrapped. Actually, now that I see the individual wraps, I wonder if I've seen these at people's workstations before. It's a green lozenge. Yeah, tastes like matcha milk. Yeah, that's fine.
Hooray!
Thanks, Doug.
I mainly got it for you. Like, the justification was the gift message.
Well, I assumed it was a free shipping thing, but...
Well, that too. It also cost me, like, -$4 to get you it.
But this is better than, like, a package of crackers.
No, it would have been all grape Sour Patch Kids.
Anyway.
Oh, you can get that?
Yeah, and it would have been, like, 2 cents cheaper than the matcha milk candy.
Dude, my former seatmate at work, now we all work from home, so he doesn't sit next to me anymore. But he would just buy just the banana of Runtz. And he'd just He had a giant ass bag of just banana Runtz. Then he would just snack on it all day.
That's pretty great, actually.
So, Dark City. Sorry, I'm being real gross because I can feel the saliva in my mouth just salivating.
Oh, now I feel the saliva. You are now aware of your own saliva.
So, Dark City is a movie by Alex Proyas, director of The Crow. And hold on, did the back of this thing say iRobot? It does say iRobot.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he directed iRobot. Yeah,
iRobot as well.
Wow.
He also directed that Nick Cage numerology movie.
Ah, knowing. Yeah, I did know that. Yeah, I guess after the relative success of like The Crow and things, he had enough clout to get a weirder movie off the ground, namely this. It sounds like Disney was, of all companies, initially interested, but they wanted a lot more control and changes. And then New Line Cinema came along and were basically like, we'll give you more or less carte blanche. They filmed in Australia, partly because Alex Proyas is Australian. And they made a whole bunch of huge sets. Basically, everything that you see in the movie is a set as opposed to like a location. It turns out they did not go to space. And actually, some of the sets they used for the subsequent science fiction movie filmed in Australia called The Matrix.
Oh, so, all right. Little
fact there. Yeah.
Seems like they used some of the plot, too. But
yeah.
Look, I realize that, you know, The Matrix came out a year later, so they probably wouldn't have had time to actively steal ideas from it, and it's probably just coincidence, but it's still a fun coincidence, a lot of the stuff that's similar.
I will say, in my notes, I wrote down, and I quote, elements of The Matrix, question mark?
You could scratch out that question mark now.
Yep.
Don't need a brain plug. All you need is liquid.
So New Line, although they gave him more or less control, basically after the previews and for test audiences more or less didn't go well, they basically prevailed upon him to make changes to the movie, including cutting out a lot of just like scene setting shots, that kind of thing. And then the major change was they requested that the theatrical version start with a voiceover from Kiefer Sutherland that basically explains what the strangers are and what they're doing. And then also has a shot of the city changing as they do their tuning thing, which kind of gives away the game of at least one of the twists immediately out the gate. New Line did this because they felt, I guess, test scientists were really confused by the movie and they were trying to make them slightly less confused.
Our test audience is always so confused.
I assume they just pull in random families off the street.
Yeah. Don't tell them where they're going. They're just, hey, you, get in here.
Do you want to be like low-key kidnapped right now?
They absolutely do that. When I was in fourth grade, I was in LA with my dad. He was out there on a business, like a prolonged business trip. And I got to go out there briefly, and we were at Grumman's Chinese Theater, and we were approached by people who were doing exactly that, and they were like, hey, we've got this thing that we're screening, do you want to be part of the test audience? And like, we had somewhere else to be, so we didn't do it, but it was enough that in retrospect I can vouch from firsthand experience that they absolutely just pull random people off the street for these things. So like, wow. It was not necessarily a sci-fi audience that was watching this when they were like, I'm confused.
I mean, to be fair to those test audiences, slightly. It is a fairly dense movie, I feel like.
I was confused.
The director's cut, at least, doesn't do a lot of hand-holding, which is kind of nice, honestly.
A lot of showing. And
yeah, this is pretty much Charlie's ideal movie, as far as I can tell.
I realize that the director's cut, you know, is set up that way, but unfortunately, having seen the movie already, that kind of cold open setup was pretty much spoiled for me because I remembered enough about the movie.
I mean, to be fair, the director's cut still introduces the strangers fairly early. So it doesn't spend too much time as a amnesiac murder mystery thing. Like, it gets to the weird pretty quick.
Yeah, I would say very quick. Yeah. I mean, when I say I was confused, I would say that it was like confused in a good way, like where I should have been confused as it unraveled, you know?
Gotcha.
Yeah, it was interesting. I mean, I remember the plot. That's basically it. So I think it was a different, very different experience watching it this time where, yeah, I kind of knew where it was going. So just kind of got to watch it get there. I don't know. Like even the first scene, you're like, all right, oh, goldfish, I get it. Rat in the maze, I get it.
The rat in the maze was very on the nose.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, is this on the nose like the first time you see it or is it not? Like, I have no concept.
It was the first time I saw it, and as soon as they showed that, I was like, oh, this is symbolic. It did not seem subtle to me.
What experiment was he running? That's of value to him. I didn't think about that till the end. I was like, yeah, okay. Can the rat get through the maze? Yes. Or does this do that for fun?
The rat got to the center, and there wasn't even a piece of cheese.
Unless it had made it to the center, ate the piece of cheese, and then was working its way back out.
Or maybe it had been imprinted by a rat that had solved the maze and knew there was a piece of cheese there. I mean, that's pretty generous reading, but maybe.
So the implication here is that rats have souls.
I don't know. Maybe, I guess.
Although, as we see near the end of the movie, the entire premise was faulty, though. So maybe not.
Doesn't matter. It could still get published.
I mean, if anything has souls, then rats have souls. It's got to, you know, they're just like rat-sized, right?
Rat-sized souls?
Yeah. So what did we think about all the practical sets?
I thought it was really cool. I was really impressed by the visual style.
I agree. I thought the aesthetic look was excellent. The, like, Dick Tracy noir-ish kind of thing. I liked it.
Yeah, mixed with like German expressionist style.
Yeah.
Looks, yeah.
I also liked how the strangers explained that they just built it from like different times. Like it's very sort of noir sensibility, but you can kind of explain away anything that isn't like consistent with a particular time period by saying it's all time periods. Yeah.
The anachronisms are canon.
Right, but that's fine, yeah. We know there's something a little off, even if you do see something a little weird. I also like in particular, the glasses, you know, before they had the, you know, the hinges that bend backwards on them.
I didn't even notice this.
Yeah, just like little, you know, wire ear pieces that go back, that kind of bend a little bit because they're flexible, but.
Oh, I never noticed that.
Is that different from modern glasses? I thought all glasses were like that.
No, they've got like hinges that like fold backward so you can lie them down. What are you talking about?
What?
Is this like a different universe? So that again? I really don't know this.
Glasses don't have hinges?
Just to the side of the lenses where the...
What about sunglasses?
Sunglasses?
What's the sun?
I will say that off the bat, one area where I felt they kind of got off on the wrong foot was that I personally found it really hard to root for the bad guy from The Holiday.
I mean, to be fair, that's in his future.
Yes, but I saw this later. So I was like, I don't know. I kind of hope this guy gets got. Because I saw how he treated Kate Winslet, and I'm not on board.
I take it that's The Holiday is a rom-com or something?
It is. It's cute. Christmas rom-com.
With Jack Black.
That we watch every year in my house. And we love that movie here. And I got to be honest, don't like that guy.
See, to me, he looks a lot like Clive Owen, and like it's basically, how do I say his name? Is it Rufus Sewell?
Jasper.
It's not Jasper.
Okay, so Rufus Jasper.
Wow.
No, so
Sewell.
So yeah, Rufus Sewell is to Clive Owen as Logan Marshall Green is to Tom Hardy.
I don't know that I get that vibe, honestly.
You don't feel like you could replace him with Clive Owen in this movie and wouldn't be very much different?
I mean, I guess maybe.
And just a little curl of hair on the front, like flopping around, I guess. I don't know.
don't know, a lot of times it made me feel think of like 80s era Billy Joel. So
no, oh, yeah.
I was just seeing Jude Law the whole time, and so the holiday reference really confused me for a second.
No, I can see the Jude Law resemblance. Okay.
So what I'm hearing is that Rufus Sewell is everything to everyone.
He's the perfect actor, yes.
But he is literally Jasper in The Holiday.
Oh.
And I have a hard time getting over that.
You don't find Jasper the unsung hero of The Holiday?
No, he is terrible. I mean, to the extent that, like, in all honesty, hats off to Rufus Sewell for, like, playing a really good, like, sleazebag. But but I see him in other movies, and I'm like, nope, kind of hope he gets got.
Charlie, what are your thoughts on that?
He was just in a TV series on Netflix called The Diplomat, and he was really good at that. He was also an asshole in that, but like a lovable asshole.
Yeah, he's really good at playing an asshole, and I mean that like to his credit. Like,
he is, yeah.
He's good at that. Because I think he was also in 28 Days with Sandra Bullock. He's like the, when she's trying to get clean, he's the guy that keeps trying to knock her off the wagon kind of thing. Like, he's just like, he's really good at being this dude that's like a problem and like a supporting character that's just a problem.
Yeah.
Well, he certainly caused some problems for the strangers in this movie.
Yes, he did.
For what it's worth, that's not Rufus Sewell in 28 Days.
Oh, it's not?
I'm pretty sure that's Dominic West.
Oh, I think
another
you're right.
Confusing. Yeah.
In my defense, it's been like 20 years since I've seen that, but in my head, it was the bad guy from The Holiday.
Is it possible because his character in 28 Days is named Jasper?
Maybe in some weird recess of like my lizard brain, possibly.
I feel like we need to start a conspiracy board.
Is Rufus Sewell actually Dominic West?
Yeah, I mean, his IMDb picture does look a lot like Jude Law, like in the face.
That's why I was like, Jude Law isn't the bad guy in The Holiday.
Oh, Jude Law is a hero in The Holiday. If anything, Cameron Diaz is the bad guy in that story.
I can't believe they hired two actors who look so much like each other.
Maybe that was an intentional choice. I like how this Dark City podcast is a deep dive on The Holiday.
This Holiday podcast. It's a good movie. Well, it'll be first in the rom-com March.
If you want a deep dive on The Holiday, look up Brandon at Random, an episode from a couple of years ago. We deep dive The Holiday in that one.
Nice. All right, add to the blog, Charlie.
Will do.
All right, so other than being a villain in a different movie, in this movie, how did you think Rufus Sewell did playing an amnesiac, telekinetic, whatever is going on?
I actually thought he was really good for the part.
Yeah, especially considering that he can't have a real backstory. He's got fake memories, and that's just what he has to go with. So, yeah, I thought he did a great job.
Yeah, I was definitely convinced that his character legitimately didn't know what the hell was going on.
It was like written in a good way where it wasn't like, you know, you didn't have to waste a lot of time with him being like, what the hell? You know, like he was pretty quick to act, but not so quick to act that you're like, oh, it's Jason Bourne. You know?
It was definitely instincts that anybody would have had, like, whoa, a bunch of weirdos just showed up with knives looking like they're going to kill me. I better go the other way.
Run away from the one with the people with the clicking child. Don't want.
I don't know what they're up to, but I ain't going that way.
Because that's actually a good point, because I thought to the scene where Kiefer Sutherland offers him the vial and it's like, you got to inject this into your head. And he's like, you know what? I'm not going to do that, but I'm also not going to throw it away. Let me just keep it for now and decide later. I'm like, yeah. All right, yeah.
Look, it's Chekhov's syringe.
That was a reasonable response. I'm not going to smash it, but I'm also not going to jam it into my forehead. I'll just put it in my pocket for now.
Apply directly to the forehead.
Good one, Paul.
And then, yeah, Kiefer Sutherland, speaking of syringes.
One thing that I never quite figured out was, like, was he playing two characters or one character with a really weird range of, like, situation?
I think he was supposed to be one character.
Because, like, when we saw him near the beginning with the rat in the maze, he was, like, very, very, like, almost slick. Other times we saw him and he was, like, this hunchback, limping, weird voice and demeanor and everything, like, talking out the side of his mouth. And then we saw him in that scene with the mouse and he was, like, super with it and... I don't know.
I always thought he was a weirdo the whole movie, honestly. So
if Jennifer Connelly comes into your office and starts asking you some questions, you know, I think it's pretty normal to, you know, stand up straighter and try to be a bit more lucid. Yeah. Whereas the rest of it, it's like, well, who is he trying to impress? The strangers don't care.
But let's be honest, Jennifer Connelly walks into your office and starts asking you questions. Most likely, that's when you become a bumbling idiot.
Yeah, he's got a point. I don't know if I've ever directly said this before or like on a podcast, but Jennifer Connelly has incredible eyes. There, I said it.
You heard it here first. Well,
I'm not taking it back.
I would not disagree with you.
We seen her in the Mary Marvel movie March. Have we seen her in the sci-fi shuffle yet?
Seems like maybe no, we would have been. I don't believe so. Okay. No, but we have, as you said, seen her in the Marvel March, marching her way through Hulk.
Oh, right. She was in the Terrible Hulk movie.
Hey, now.
She was in one of the Terrible Hulk movies.
I was just going to say William Hurt is in the other Hulk movie. The other terrible Hulk movie, I guess.
Let's not reopen those old wounds. But what do people think of Jennifer Connelly? Yeah.
I mean, she's good. I don't think she has tons to do here beyond just like inquire about the main character's whereabouts.
Yeah, I'm biased. I always like Jennifer Connelly and everything. Since the days of Labyrinth, she's always been one of my favorites. I like her a lot.
I actually thought in the beginning of the movie, she was a little flat in her delivery, but it seemed like everyone was a little flat in their delivery, like William Hurt also. So I wasn't quite sure if that was like a deliberate choice that the director was going for to kind of have everyone underplay stuff a bit.
So yeah. I noticed that definitely with her character, but I very much thought it was deliberate. Like, I thought it was like kind of part of that like passive noir attitude where like, because the way she was singing in the club and stuff seemed very like toned down. And I thought that was kind of what they were going for because, yeah, like you said, like William Hurt was kind of toned down. Like everybody was sort of flat and other than Rufus Sewell, who was like cranked up to 11 because he just woke up in a bathtub with a dead body next to him and, you know, freaking out. Everybody else was like almost the extreme other way. Cool.
Yeah, that's fair. Like maybe there's a contrast being set there.
Yeah. At least that's the way.
The more extreme you are, basically the more like memories people seem to have, the more like crazy they, you know, like Kiefer Sutherland, like, he knows all kinds of stuff. He's kind of weird, just like the, you know.
The detective?
Yeah. Anyone who glimpses the truth as they start to get there, you know. So if they start flat, they have somewhere to go as they sort of unravel.
That's true. That's actually a reasonable point, I think.
And you also wonder, too, like, whether Jennifer Connelly... I mean, we know that at the end of this movie, she isn't a singer. Like, was she a singer before that? Or was William Hurt a detective before that? So it's kind of like... Yeah, you're wondering if like how they're doing their jobs or what they're doing at any particular time, specifically like right after midnight, like whether they even really know what it is they're doing.
I mean, I don't think there's an actual working economy here, so I don't think it really matters what anyone's job is, right?
I don't know. He needed to get his wallet from the automat.
Yeah, where do they get the food for that?
Yeah, that was such a terrible prank that the guy played on him. Because it's like, how am I supposed to pay for this? My money's in my wallet.
That green jello looked pretty good at the automat.
So we get this noirish environment that has a lot of like the noir sort of touchstones, I guess you'd say. So, you know, beautiful woman, dead body, filmed at night. an amnesiac, you know, not exactly film noir, but kind of in that realm. And then it introduces this distinctly sci-fi element of the strangers. And I wondered how people felt about that initial sort of reveal, not so much of like just the first appearance, but like the first appearance of like all of them were like Ian Richardson's down there and stuff.
The first time I seen this, I had not seen any of the Hellraiser movies. And now that I have, I was like, oh yeah, this feels very Hellraiser. Like with all the sort of leather coat outfits, white bald characters, chattering teeth stuff. Not in a bad way. I thought it was effective here.
But how did you think it worked in relation to what the movie had been doing up to that
point? Oh, yeah.
I thought it was like pretty cool. I can't remember actually like what the first shot is where they show everyone, because they're just sort of hinting at it for a while. And like, do you see like some of the strangers before you actually see them in their like underground chamber?
Yeah, because they show up in the hotel room, right?
Oh, okay.
And they start doing weird stuff to like the hotel clerk and whatnot.
I could see being a little bit confused if you didn't. Like if you were a test audience and hadn't seen the, like the Matrix, or didn't even know this was a sci-fi movie.
Well, you obviously haven't seen the Matrix yet.
Yeah. Exactly. So like, it's like when you're more familiar with the tropes, I'm like, oh, cool. Like, but I can see how it would be jarring. Like, where the hell is this? You know, where it's like, oh, clearly there's something else going on. But as having gone in like completely, like knowing nothing about this movie, not having seen any other editions, I thought it was very like the way they did it. I don't know, just kind of pulled along like the mystery, or made it kind of interesting, or just really held my attention about like wondering what's going on.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I thought they did a good job of balancing like the slow unraveling of the mystery kind of, and keeping you like following along without making too big of leaps at a time or losing you completely, if that makes sense. Not to jump ahead too far, but until like the very end, I thought they almost fell into like the thing that bothers me sometimes about such movies, where they suddenly give this like diarrhea of the mouth monologue about what's all going on.
Yeah.
Like all at once. But for the most part, I thought they did a pretty good job of getting there slowly, of like people you're discovering as the characters are discovering what the hell is going on, but not being sure.
Yeah.
So knowing what was going on ahead of time, it actually was still kind of rewarding to watch, because you know all of the stuff that's coming, but there's a lot of things that just aren't drawn attention to very closely. Like the first time we see the broken syringe in the hotel room, like it's a broken syringe, but you know, you have no idea why or what it is, except when you do, you're like, oh yeah, okay. They're clearly showing you all of the stuff that is relevant later.
Well, that like same opening scene, one of the ones that I noticed like way later when they kind of did the reveal at the end, was like even the overhead light that was swinging in the back in the bathroom there was because the Kiefer Sutherland character had like knocked into it as he stumbled out frantically. Even that kind of came back around as relevant of like as he woke up, someone was just there.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I just thought that was a nice touch.
Yeah. I thought that was like a good attention to detail.
Wait, so hold on. The girl in the first room, who killed her?
I think the idea is that the strangers either killed her or they just pulled a corpse out from wherever they're storing the bodies.
I thought they just like sort of planted a dead body and then like
right,
did a little bit of spirograph on it.
Yeah, because they're trying to do the setup.
Right. They want to see like, oh, if we set him up as a murderer, will he be a murderer? Like, we give him all those memories, etc. So it's very helpful for them just to put a dead body there so he finds it. I'm like, I guess I am a murderer.
Right. Well, I assume he also has the memories of murdering her.
Yes, yeah, that's what Kiefer Sutherland was trying to put in.
Tried to, right?
I'm saying that, you know, if their plan had gone according to plan, he right. would have.
I think that's why the one stranger who gets implanted gets all bloodthirsty and stuff. Mr. Hand, was that one?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The guy who played Riff Raff in Rocky Horror. Richard O'Brien, I think.
Oh, yeah.
But this brings us to a larger question that I would like to pose, and that is the stranger's plan. What is it?
So that is an excellent, excellent question, because on my last page of notes, I made a little plot holes section. had minor and major, only a couple of each, but my major one was, how are the aliens going to prolong life by figuring out the soul of humans? Humans are mortal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sort of
what were they going like for?
Grasping at ideas.
Like, I don't know. I couldn't
it
really
seemed
make
like two separate
connection.
Problems. It's a good point. They're like, our race is dying, but besides, we also want a soul. That's just another thing we want.
Our race is dying. If we can figure out what makes humans unique, what their soul is, whatever, then, you know, this other thing that dies way more quickly than we do, maybe we can live for, I don't know. That I couldn't quite bridge that gap there.
My best guess was that they're dying of like some sort of collective ennui and they need individuality to reinvigorate themselves or something. Yeah, that was my best guess.
This is an Ayn Rand.
That's more than what I got.
And I mean, this problem kind of goes away too if they just didn't say that their race was dying. If they were just like, we don't like being who we are, we want to be humans. Like, that's in and of itself enough. So I don't know.
Or we just want to do science.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Right.
Badly.
Yeah.
Well, look, not everyone gets the scientific method right.
I mean, it's still as long as you get publishable results, right? Doesn't matter if they're good or not.
Also, does that mean there's a control city floating around somewhere?
Yeah, it's Earth.
Oh. Twist ending.
Earth is the control. Inject a little Hitchhiker's Guide in there.
That's right.
Yeah, I don't know. That actually would have made more sense than like, we want to crack the code of something about you that we can't even prove because then we can live forever like you don't.
They spent a Maybe lot of time listening to Oasis. They believed we live forever.
Yeah, among my minor plot hole was the fact that like water killed them or, you know, whatever. Like,
they just didn't like it.
But when they splashed the one guy with water and the little tuning thing in his brain freaked out and like sprang out of him and then like turned to ash and disintegrated. Meanwhile, the character who has the super strong tuning that like leads to their downfall woke up in a bathtub full of water unaffected. So that was something that, like, didn't seem to quite make sense to me.
I don't think it's that tuning makes you averse to water. I think it's just that their species doesn't like water. They're like cats, right?
So yeah, I've had cats that love water.
You might have missed
trying to generalize here, Dan.
It's the milk to their earnest, scared, stupid troll.
And Brian is mad at you now.
You might have missed.
You mean
it,
Miak?
Didn't think I could find any this time of year.
That weird thing that freaked out and turned into ash. That actually was the stranger. Like,
oh, so are they like? Are
like,
they hosts
they're just
inside?
They're just piloting dead bodies, like dead human bodies, much like the little guy in Men in Black is piloting that, you know, human android.
Oh.
Yeah.
Like, it was a throwaway line, you know, blink and you miss it, but
we also get like the shot of it like going into the head and seeing the little parasite in there or whatever.
Well, I saw that. I thought that was just like a part of the brain that was like responsible for the tuning. But that was the actual stranger.
Ritter. Yeah, they're just piloting giant mechs from their perspective.
Oh.
Yeah, it's like Inside
now
Out.
Now I get it. All right.
It's exactly like Inside Out.
Big check
mark. I haven't seen Inside Out, but it's a mecha?
Yep.
Mecha anime? Wow. Yep.
If anyone asks, tell them your favorite mecha anime is Inside Out.
If they were trying to figure things out, it's almost like it seemed to me John being able to tune was like their first successful experiment. Like,
yeah, that's why they said they were going to stop doing the other experiments.
Yeah, they believe in replicability.
They don't got time for that.
So we can shut down the whole city because now we've got this guy.
But not before we wipe his wife's brain.
Well, look, it's called being efficient.
Your or whoever was legal name is Targus.
I don't get that one.
Sorry. Oh, what were you about to say, Dan?
He said wiping his wife's brain or whoever, the person that they had like uploaded memories into for the moment to be his wife.
Well, there was the whole thing about they can't fake love or whatever was going on in the jail cell, not cell. What do you call that thing?
The
visitation room
thing.
Yeah, where he breaks the glass and that doesn't really faze her that much. She's just like, oh, okay.
It turned her on. She wanted to make out after that.
Yeah, she was like, I'll kiss the hero of the holiday, sure.
Villain. Speaking of which, I don't think I wrote it down, but I did make a mental note of like of that entire like 2 hour long movie. They do one like flashback montage of like their love history. And I did think to myself, like, how many scenes did they film for a 10-second montage of them two making out? Like, did they spend like 3 days on set making out for that like 10 seconds of like, here's us making out 75 times through our life?
I hope so.
And then I'm like, you know, I should have gone into acting.
That's right.
Oh my gosh. It should have been me.
This guy spent 3 days making out with Jennifer Connelly for like this 10-second montage.
It's probably deeply unpleasant. It's like, all right, hold it.
It would
for
probably
3 seconds.
Get weird after a while, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Lip muscles quivering, tired.
I need chapstick.
Hyper aware of your own saliva.
Conscious of yourself.
Just noticing your nose whistling slightly.
Right.
Another thing which I liked, a lot of the times when a new character is introduced and they give a little bit of backstory about themselves, they deliver it oddly, like they're delivering a line, because it's not really their history, their personal history. It's just the role that they're playing. I think in particular, when William Hurt and Jennifer Connelly are in the car together and she comments on the accordion, he says something about how it was a gift from his mother. And the way in which he says that line is just very off. Like, it's unnatural.
So,
like, the other one was that they really draw attention to is how she's constantly fidgeting with the wedding ring.
Oh, like she's not used to wearing it, they
say? Yeah. Despite allegedly being married for 4 years, she never, you know, she never takes it off. Like, they're like that line, however she delivered that line, is another one which seemed just slightly, almost like a reflexive response rather than something that is actually considered.
And the one that I picked up on, I think the first one that I picked up on, and it kind of came back around and confirmed itself later on when another character did the same exact thing, was when he was in the cab and the guy couldn't quite remember how to get to Shell Beach. And like, he couldn't remember what street it was. He was like, was it Main Street or was it West Street or whatever it was?
Was it Crosstown?
Like, yeah, like he couldn't quite remember. And I remember, however it was delivered, for whatever reason, that stuck in my head even that first time. And I just kind of thought it was odd how he couldn't quite remember. And so then later on, when William Hurt similarly couldn't quite remember how to get there, it, like, I immediately remembered the cab driver and was like, oh, this is a thing. Nobody knows how to get there. So I felt like they did a good job of that kind of stuff, of like these little clues.
Yeah.
That things aren't quite right.
I think it helps to have William Hurt here in particular, because we know, like, he's a really good actor. I mean, I think everyone here is doing a pretty good job, but here it's like, you know that all of that's intentional, because like, we know he could give a much better line delivery if that's what we were going for here. And I also think it's really fun too, how I'm not sure how good of a detective he is. I mean, he does what he needs to here, but there's some things that like don't quite add up. He's like, what sort of killer would save a goldfish? And I'm like, I don't know. I've watched a lot of movies about like weird killers and dudes, all sorts of bizarre things like that, like animals more than humans.
There was something about his character that I felt was like, I feel like it added a lot, because they almost like frame him as an early sort of antagonist, you know, and he's kind of that, like, seems like he has it all together, but it almost felt like, yeah, like those cracks in his policing skills were, you know, they seem like pretty intentional. He comes off as like the sort of hyper competent, detail oriented detective. And then, you know, as he kind of, you know, becomes more aware of all the weirdness going on, then he forgets to tie his own shoe and all that.
Yeah. It feels like he's playing a part that they've given him. Like, this right. is the noir detective, yeah. and that's the memory that you've been injected with.
Yeah.
How did everybody like the tuning, and the tuning effects?
I thought it was fine for the time period, you know, for 1998, but it looked pretty good.
A lot of that was definitely what I, what made me think of The Matrix when I made that note, was like how it just reminded me of like Matrix code, the way that the doors would like appear and disappear and that stuff would change. It felt very Matrixy.
Yeah, I agree with Adam that, yeah, it's basically fine with the one exception of when they're having the tuning fight at the end. The part where it's like, like, I just laughed out loud.
To be fair, I missed that slightly because that's the moment at which Dan was trying to call me an hour early for the Skype call.
You just so
I was distracted at that point.
I watched it on Sunday night. Yeah, I thought I was late. And I got on here. I was like, somebody dial me in. I was trying to call him. He was like, we're doing this at 9, not 8. And I was like, oh. So, yeah. So
he told me he was going to play Diablo 4.
Yeah, and I did. It was excellent. Yeah, but I thought the same thing, and I actually made a note of it. I thought it was so funny. It was when they were leaning forward, mouth agape,
yep.
while brain battling. He was just like, I just pictured them in the studio, like, now lean forward and just, you know, put this dumb look on your face and we'll just CGI the rest. Yeah. It was really bizarre.
Kind of felt like some sort of anime duel.
Yeah, very much so.
Actually, I did read that part of the end sequence was inspired by the ending of Akira.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
The only other, I guess, action-esque sequence that I thought was kind of silly was when he was hanging out the door, like on the ledge, and the kid had a knife in his hand, but then chose to like get down on all fours and bite his hand instead. I was like, that seems kind of silly.
That's like, what kids do, man.
Yeah, that was that for some reason.
But we knew he wasn't a kid.
Just like, of all the things you were going to make this creepy little kid do, it's going to be tight. That's the worst it's like, one.
It's like, yeah, that part just felt a little over the top of me. I was like, yeah.
The look of it sort of felt like, oh, it could have easily been very dated 90s CGI, but they, I don't know, it matched the visual style well enough for like the various tuning scenes with the buildings twisting and all that I was pretty impressed at how much it didn't detract at all. Like,
I thought the special effects were fine.
Like, in terms of the special effects, when they were doing a lot of the building morphing stuff, I genuinely couldn't tell what was model work and what was like visual effects work. Like, because a lot of it was stuff where you're like, I can see how you would do this with visual effects, but I'm not convinced that it is visual effects. So I thought they did a really great job with that.
I agree.
Yeah. Yeah.
Also, yeah, it was funny when the guy got squished between the buildings and they had the splatter. That was the funny bit.
Yeah, I think visually this movie is really, really good. Like, it's a very coherent sort of palette, I guess you would say.
Yeah. Yeah, it's like they have a consistent like look that they're trying to get with the colors and the lighting, isn't there?
Yeah.
So after that big Akira battle, we get the end of the movie where we finally, I guess, get to Shell Beach? We get to create Shell Beach.
Well, before we get to Shell Beach, we see clear evidence that the Earth is in fact flat. That is exactly how it would work.
I did not realize that I was watching some sort of stealth flat earther movie. That was your real goal in choosing this, wasn't it, Dan?
You're on to me.
This is one of the sacred texts. the decision that John made where he was like, you know, I can build anything I want. I thought that was kind of interesting. I guess there wasn't really any other choice to make. Like they weren't like, cause in my mind I was like, oh, they're going to like find Earth or something. Or they're like going to, they're going to do something. But really he was like, no, I'm building my own matrix, a better matrix.
Well, yeah,
I'm going to be happy in this one. And
a happy matrix with a post-apocalyptic dystopian beach with a weird wasteland behind it.
That's well, he doesn't beautiful. Even know. They don't even know that Earth exists or where they're from or who they are. So I don't know.
So in my head canon, part of the reason that the Dark City was directed the way it was is because on the bottom of the city was where all the solar panels are. So now that he's moved the city, they're going to lose power and die. That's not true. I'm just making a joke. I didn't actually think that. And then, yeah, Shell Beach is an outcrop. Who knew? With a lighthouse for all the ships coming by.
I felt whisked along. I was perfectly happy with however much information and backstory I was given at any time. But at the end, I was like, well, what the hell are they going to do now? I want an info dump now. Give me a long, detailed epilogue. That's what I would have done if I was a test audience, I think. I was like,
you just wanted like the little text afterwards.
Yeah.
John and Anna eventually got married.
Like, is this going to be an entirely beach-based world? Like, they know, like, nothing else.
So. Like, where are they going to get their food?
The automat!
Well, I guess he could just tune them some food, right?
Yeah, whatever you like.
He tuned them the water.
They're just going to tune back to what the strangers did. The cycle begins again. I mean, it could.
Only if you care about science. Strangers were all about doing science, you know, setting up experiments like what does it do to a person if they're a murderer? But, you know, they can't run those experiments anymore.
Yeah, so they did the trading places experiment, too. What happens if someone who's poor is rich now? Let's watch.
So did you like that ending then?
I kind of did. Like, it was the same as Paul where I was kind of like, well, what's going to happen now? And I'm just glad they didn't explain it. It's like, this is where we are. You can imagine what might happen. Maybe there's another movie. Maybe there isn't. We don't need to overdo it.
Yeah, I do think it feels like it was probably the best ending possible. And
Dark City 2, The Village.
Oh, Dark City. I'm going to write to M. Night Shyamalan about this. Please do a Dark City 2. Except don't tell anyone that it's Dark City 2 and that's the twist. And like a few people will get it. Like, oh, it just happened to have just watched Dark City for some reason before I saw this unrelated M. Night Shyamalan movie.
I thought the ending was fine. As for as good of a job as they did for 95% of the movie of like letting it unfold and discovering along with the characters, I did think there was a little bit of overacceleration at the end where suddenly like Kiefer Sutherland's like, here's what's really going on, yada, yada, yada. And then they just like jump through that as opposed to like a moment that reveals something. It was like they kind of leaned on just, hey, have somebody suddenly explain it to them. Other than that, I like where they ended up and generally how they got there.
I'd forgotten something about the first time I watched, because I had the same feeling this time, which is when he gets injected and we start to see the explanation from Kiefer Sutherland about like how to use his powers. The very first thing I thought for like half a second was like, wait a second, Kiefer Sutherland was the ice cream man back on Earth? Like, that's the reveal?
He was dead all along.
Yeah. It's like, what a strange story.
He was grooming him since he was a kid.
It's his destiny to tune. I will admit to also having that disconnect a bit of just being like, wait, what? What? Huh?
I thought the way in which they presented that initially was that it was supposed to look like the memories from the serial killer version of John. And so you're supposed to think that it's like, oh no, he tricked him. It's really got the murderer inducing memories.
Also, it wasn't just the skills to tune. He needed the will to kill, too, it planted in him.
Well, not just the disconnect of, like, wait, was Kiefer Sutherland there the whole time? Was like, for a second there, I thought to myself, oh, have they been plucking people up from Earth this whole time? And Kiefer Sutherland has, like, been subtly trying to, like, groom someone to take down the system kind of thing. But like Charlie said, it was, like, just for, like, 4 seconds. Right. I was like, oh, wait, no, that's not what's going on.
Kiefer Sutherland has always been the unequivocal good guy of this movie.
Like, oh man, he's the real hero.
All right, so a couple of random facts about Dark City that I don't know where else to put. So, but one of the things is that Roger Ebert, somewhat famously, I think, really, really liked this movie, called it the best movie of 1998. And he actually had recorded a commentary track on the DVD and Blu-ray that you can listen to if you have the physical edition. And he called it one of his great movies as well.
What's the competition in 1998, though?
I mean, I don't know, but he saw a lot of movies, so.
Yeah, okay, fair.
And then the other factoid. Reportedly, Kiefer Sutherland was initially confused on why he was being sent the script and wondered if they had meant to send it to his dad, Donald, instead.
That's pretty good. Dad, I got your mail again.
So did you enjoy Dark City? Would you recommend it to people? What are ultimately your thoughts about the film?
I liked it. I didn't love it, but I liked it. I thought it was definitely worth watching. I would watch it again. Feel like something was left on the table, but though I can't quite set my finger on what. I'd give it, like, I don't know, 7 out of 10 chattering albino children.
You don't have to give it a rating if you don't want to, but we appreciate the hustle.
But yeah, I liked it. I liked it. Very interesting. I thought it was a really interesting premise.
Yeah, it's a movie that I think I appreciated a little bit more the second time watching it, even though it was a slightly different version. But I remembered enough of it that I think that sort of helped a little bit because I could pick up on the clues a bit more. And then, yeah, just the vibe of the movie is really good. You know, yeah, that sort of film noir, almost like Terry Gilliam style. You know, there's a lot of Brazil, it feels like, in this movie.
Yeah, so, I could see that.
Yeah, I think it's a really well-constructed movie. I enjoyed it a lot.
At the risk of sounding really pretentious, it had a very rich tapestry.
Yeah. Oh, the one thing I will say, though, is I thought the score was very late 90s generic. Sorry, Trevor Jones, but your score didn't do it for me. But everything else, thumbs up. I can see why Roger Ebert liked it.
So yeah, I really, really liked it. You know, I did think that the plot and overall story was good, and it was revealed in, like, tasteful bits, you know. I'm glad that I just knew nothing about it and saw only the director's cut. But really, yeah, what made it stand out to me is the visual style and the overall vibes. It came at kind of an interesting point for me too, because I've just been kind of getting into noir in general. So I was like, oh, we're watching a sci-fi noir movie. This is, like, kind of the exact perfect time in my life to watch it. Also, it kind of oddly made me want to go watch all the 90s Batman movies again.
Oh, I can see that. I mean, yeah, there's definitely similar architecture, I think, going on there.
Yeah, just like that, like, dark, but, like, also, like, kind of strange and uncanny-ness to the
looming.
Yeah. Aside from just being good, it was, like, the right movie for me to be watching right now. So, yeah, strong recommend for anyone who enjoys those sort of vibes, I think.
Yeah, real quick, you mentioned you only watched the director's cut. I had mentioned way back at the very beginning that after watching the director's cut, I just watched the beginning of the theatrical release, because I had heard, as Adam mentioned, that, like, the beginning, they kind of give it away. So after I watched the movie, I watched the very beginning just to be like, well, I want to see what they said now that I've watched it. And the giveaway, I'm not sure that it would have actually made me enjoy the movie a whole lot less. But at the same time, I'm kind of glad I watched the director's cut first and didn't have the giveaway because I didn't think they needed, I didn't think it was necessary, but I don't think it was a, would have completely ruined the movie.
I, like you did afterwards, watch just like the opening bit. And yeah, I think I can see why people sort of say, hey, don't watch that version.
Yeah.
Or at least like turn off the sound for like the first 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Because it gives away some of the question of like, all right, who are these weird bald people from Fringe, right? Like,
yeah.
By the way, I assume the TV show Fringe was influenced by this, at least in the look of the strangers with their watchers or whatever they're called, observers.
Yeah, I'm glad I watched the director's cut, but I don't think it would have ruined it completely, but I think it was better watching the director's cut.
Yeah, full agree with that.
So when Dan chose Dark City for the next movie, I was kind of like, oh man, because I had remembered from, you know, seeing it on TV that it was a good premise with kind of a wanting execution, particularly at the end. And watching it this time around, albeit a slightly different version, I don't really have that same complaint. It's good. Yeah, I think if you're in the mood for a sci-fi noir movie, I think it's a pretty good choice. I don't think it's a best movie of 1998, but still pretty good. Would recommend.
Yeah, I like this movie too. I remembered liking it the first time I saw it. I enjoyed it again. I just, the whole time I was really interested to see like what Dan's take would be, just to somebody who hasn't seen it before, because it's definitely a different viewing experience when you know like what the twist is and being able to catch all of those things that were confusing the first time around, but the second time around you're like, oh, okay, I see what they're doing. Like, I did feel like there was a scene with one of the dying strangers on the ground, like, and there's like, oh, this is a little bit explaining where they're explaining what their motive is, but you know, that's only from the perspective of knowing all of that anyway. Yeah, I think all the directing choices were pretty good too. It was pretty consistent, and we were able to explain everything, like why the acting was a certain way. Oh, I enjoyed it.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. And thanks, Dan, for suggesting this movie for us to watch. Sounds like we all quite enjoyed it. Dark City, a less polarizing movie than Dark Star. Let's say that.
Yes, less polarizing.
And so I believe, Charlie, it is your turn to shuffle the deck of science fiction movies. But before we do that, I'd just like to say that this is the second complete cycle, I believe, of people picking movies. So yay. After Charlie, we're going to shuffle the order.
Oh.
And we'll do that live. Shuffle. On the next episode. So
okay.
Be excited. Ready.
Everybody needs one.
Sharpen your knives.
That's right. But before we do that, Charlie gets to pick a movie for the shuffle. Charlie, what should we watch next?
Yes. I don't really feel like it's a shuffle on my end. It's a pretty obvious choice. So this movie is probably a top 10, if like not top 5 movie. Not just sci-fi movie, but like movie for me. And that's a 1989 film, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Oh.
Oh.
All right. Very nice. I haven't seen that in a while. I think the last time I saw it was when I watched it with you.
Oh, yeah.
So
I don't think I've ever seen it all the way through.
Yeah. There's a couple. I think there's like one or two small rough points, but I think overall it very largely holds up.
I just always caught it on TV too late. So I'm basically excited to see the beginning of it.
Look, my understanding is that we're going to spend the next sci-fi episode listening to Charlie apologize for all the problematic moments in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure.
Or just quoting the classic lines.
Both. That I can do, yeah.
It's going to prompt me to watch the entire, all three of them. I still haven't watched the third one.
I watched the third one on a plane, which in some ways feels like the best way to watch that movie.
Probably.
That's the best way to watch a lot of movies, let's be honest.
I actually don't know if I've ever seen the second one, to be fair.
Most people haven't. I think most people have like memories of bits and pieces of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely not what I was expecting after watching the first one.
Look, I've since seen The Seventh Seal, so now I'm ready. All right. So we get to look forward to Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. That sounds fun. In the meantime, we'll do what we normally do, podcasting with a purpose. What is that purpose? We'll figure out while the episode is recorded. I'm Adam Gobeski.
And I'm Charlie Wallace. A special thanks to our three guests. We've got Dan Hess.
In the meantime, be excellent to each other.
Paul Wilcox.
It was a pleasure.
And Doug Gobeski.
Thanks for having me.
So if you enjoyed that episode of the Gobeski Wallace Report, it doesn't have to stop there.
Are you sure?
I'm pretty sure.
Are we gonna reveal the secrets?
I'm ready if you are.
I mean, I guess they can start by following us on Facebook.
Or Twitter. Or just go to the old-fashioned internet to GobeskiWallaceReport.com.
Search AOL keyword Gobeski Wallace Report.
I think you can find us actually in the Yahoo directories if you click on entertainment, audio, miscellaneous. Ooh.
And then he says, if you're looking for the soul, you made a mistake looking in here in your brain. What is, does he just mean the heart? Like, what is...
means the heart.
Okay.
Are you kidding me?
What are you, a stranger, Charlie?
Mr. I don't like exposition. That was too subtle for him.
I was waiting for him to put his hand on his chest. I thought he had some other secret.
And I was really glad he didn't, honestly.
Yeah. I think, you know, and I think it's because he knew his audience. Like, he knew that would just confuse the strangers and they'd just like pull out his heart or something.
Well, I thought you meant the test audience watching in the theater.
Yeah, like the on vacation dad being like, where is the soul?
Plus, is that the last one of the aliens?
Yeah, he was dying.
Oh. If so, he got his wish. He didn't have a collective brain anymore. Oh, the only one.
Unfortunately for him, his brain was tainted by then.
Yeah, that's true.
Collective of one.